Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we've got Mom with us today. Hi, Mom. Hi, Caroline. Yes.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Well, good. Do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yes, I certainly do. This book is entitled Show Them Your Good, and it's a portrait of boys in the City of Angels in the year before college. The author is Jeff Hobbs, and Jeff is the author of The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and The Tourists. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife and two children. And I must say that this is an amazing book, and I hope that I would hope that it could be on the short reading list for high schoolers. I mean, it's really something. So anyway, welcome to the program.
Yeah, welcome to Writer's Voices, Jeff.
Oh, thank you, guys. It's really special to be here with you. Thank you.
So, Jeff, tell us how this book came to be.
So this book, Show Them You're Good, it kind of came from my last book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, which was a nonfiction book about a very close friend of mine, my college roommate, who passed away. And for a lot of reasons, that was a really hard book, mainly because I missed my friend. But once it came out, something very terrifying happened, which is that a lot of schools began reaching out to me and asking me to come speak, you know, come talk to assemblies, visit English classrooms. And, you know, it's intimidating talking to young people because they don't really hide what they think of you. And I was never really meant to speak in public in general. You can probably already tell that after a couple minutes. But
you're doing great, Jeff. You're doing great.
I did. I visit all these schools. I just kind of got myself wherever they asked me to go, all over the country, big groups, small groups, private schools, mostly inner city public schools, I would say, and had these conversations about, big conversations about race and class and access. But what happened was a lot of young people began sharing their own stories in fragments, and their own aspirations. And it's pretty powerful to witness a young person, particularly a young man, just assume the vulnerability required to say, this is who I am. And I heard a lot of wisdom in their voices. And wisdom is not something we often associate with teenage boys. And so all this to say, I carried that home and just kind of thought maybe there was some positive value in sharing, you know, the world in this moment in time through the lenses of young, bright people growing up.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Robert Peace and what it was in his story that struck such a chord with these young people.
Sure. Again, that was a hard one. Rob Peace was my close friend and my roommate for 4 years in college, fleeting kind of silly but also vital time. And Rob grew up the hard way. I mean, really the hardest way, in a rough neighborhood. His father was in prison for a double homicide. His mother worked very long hours for not much money, mostly in hospital and nursing home kitchens. And Rob, you know, through that interplay of his own drive and intelligence and his mother's sacrifice and good teachers and community and friendship, you know, went from there to Yale, which is where I met him and where he also sold marijuana to our classmates, which, you know, maybe didn't seem like the greatest idea, but it seemed like something he could do and maybe needed to do. And it seemed because we were in a college dorm. It seemed safe. And, you know, after he graduated, a lot of things happened. And he continued selling marijuana in spaces that were not very safe. And, yeah, he was killed in an act of violence over money. And, yeah, when he died, it's not like I was planning to write a book or anything. But, again, when people just share stories and there's power in it, and I call that book a eulogy that got way out of hand.
Well, what is your – do you have a background in writing?
Somewhat, in that I always wanted to be a writer from a young age. I mean, not to be too quaint, but I remember being at my siblings' sports games, and my annoyed dad would be calling me down from tree branches where I'd be perched with a book. And then I wrote a novel right after graduating college. And I was lucky that it was published, though I don't recommend that novel to anybody because I was pretty young. But yeah, it's what I always wanted to do, and it's what I've always spent my free time doing. So yeah, I guess you could call that a background.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. Did you study writing in college too?
I was an English major, and there was a new creative writing track at school when I got there, which I participated in, which was mostly, you know, kids telling you you're not a good writer. But,
one of those. The standard workshop approach.
Yeah, it's called the compliment sandwich, I believe.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they say something nice and they tell you what they really think and then they tell you some little nicety to conclude. But what it really did was give me a lot of time to read and a lot of time to write, sort of embedded in the college schedule, where I also played, ran track and did busy things. But again, that was always sort of the thing for me.
So this book, Show Them You're Good, A Portrait of Boys in the City of Angels in the Year Before College, you went into two high schools in Los Angeles, one in the good part of town and one in the what's considered not so good part of town, and which I've just been listening to White Fragility, so I have a kind of a different take on that whole thing of what we consider good and not so good, but in terms of schools and neighborhoods. But anyway, you picked four young men to really feature in the book, but you talk about more lives, you know, you have more men than that young men that we get to know in this book. Why those particular schools and why those four young men that you focus on?
Sure. Thanks for asking about all that. And yeah, the question kind of speaks to the very clumsy nature of the sort of nonfiction work I do. And that a lot of writers I really admire do. I guess it's called immersion journalism. And it's important to note that I didn't really pick any of these students. What happened was I mentioned, you know, I was kind of having all these ideas in my head, and I love being in schools and being with young people. And you know, this idea to give that perspective without necessarily using the device of sports or other or parenting styles. You know, there's a lot of different laundry lines you can hang a book on. And so I started reaching out to schools just and teachers I knew and just kind of floating this idea. And I learned quickly what I should have known already, which is that no principal wants some awkward journalist like me wandering around the hallways of his school, mainly because schools get dinged a lot by journalists. But these two principals, for whatever reason, did open their doors to me. This was the 2016-2017 school year, and I had to jump through a lot of hoops, and there were a lot of permissions and bureaucracy, which was interesting. But they did. It was really generous of them and courageous of them. And then as far as the students, the four main two students in each school, this is in Beverly Hills and Compton, California, which, you know, if you watch TV in the 90s or listen to music, a lot of people, you know, have an idea of what these neighborhoods look like. I guess I just put the, I guess there was an email sent to senior boys going into their senior year saying this guy's going to be hanging out, and if you want to meet him, you know, come see what you think of this idea. And groups came, and I sort of made my pitch, and mainly I was asking them for a lot of their time during a year when they did not have much time. These groups formed, and I mean, I went to classes and sports games and plays and dances and all that, but the center of the research, so to speak, was this group of boys in each school. We would gather once a week throughout the year for about an hour, 2 hours, usually sometimes even 3 or 4 hours. And I just asked them what was going on, and we'd have these round table free association conversations, and that's sort of what formed the book.
Now, Caroline, you spent a number of years in high schools.
Mm-hmm, I did.
So I kind of like, yeah, teaching English in high school. So I just, So what questions and comments do you have about this?
Well, I was curious as to why you didn't include any females in this.
Oh, I get asked that question a lot. And it's an important question because I think females are really interesting, and their insights are valuable. And I've been married to one for 15 years, and I'm raising a daughter. So I understand the question. And there's a couple reasons. The main one is that I felt that I sort of explained the research structure of this round table, and I thought that having teenage boys and girls together kind of probing their own emotional lives, you know, might not make for the most authentic, honest conversations, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Another approach had to do with the idea of sort of masculinity and male machismo. I mean, I think we still live in a machismo culture. I mean, it's getting more progressive, and there's lots of books about how to raise sensitive boys, and I've read some of those books, and I've gotten a lot from them. But at the same time, if you're a young man and you get pushed down at recess, I have a son as well. You know, you're not supposed to cry. You're not supposed to tell a teacher, and young men aren't, at least in my orbit, given too much credit for the complexity of their thoughts. And I thought it would just be interesting to, like I said, and as authentic a way as possible, kind of explore what's behind that veil of masculinity.
Well, I think that's a really good answer, and I think that was an authentic reason that you had, and it worked out well for you.
Well, thank you. I said, I would have loved to have girls involved as well. And, you know, there were mothers and girlfriends, teachers, and a lot of female perspectives in the story as well, kind of on the periphery of the story that were very mm-hmm. important.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeff Hobbs, author of Show Them You're Good. Jeff, when I Googled you, you know, you mentioned that you're married, and so what comes up first is, you know, your birth date, your spouse, your education at Yale University, and then your marriage location, which I thought was a really funny tidbit to come up in the summary of you, that you were married at Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York.
Well, that's bizarre. I don't recall ever putting that up there.
I thought that was really funny. It also, in your Amazon bio, it says you grew up in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. Isn't that where they grow all the mushrooms?
It is. edible mushrooms.
Edible mushrooms, yes.
That you put on salad. The mushroom capital of the world, mm-hmm. in fact.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I grew up partially in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which isn't too far from there.
Oh, no, not far at all.
Yeah. Yep. So, okay, so in this book, were you kind of setting out... I mean, the book is mostly about these young men's attempts and struggles to get into a good college and to show the college admissions officers that they were good enough to get into these schools. Was that always intended to be the focus of the book, or did that come about during kind of as you were talking to these kids?
The admissions process was, it was always there. And so possibly earlier when I said I didn't want to hang this story on a device, I was talking out of both sides of my mouth, because the admissions process is very much the spine of this book. I'm not sure that I intended that going in, but especially as the fall of that year, 2016, moved along, and college became this, it went from being this sort of abstract, busy chore that they would have to endure at some point to being, you know, this very intense process that they were actually in. I mean, the weight of it really, it took me by surprise, and what came out of these conversations that was interesting to me and that I didn't totally recall from my own experience, you know, now kind of a long time ago, is that applying to college is a very bizarre act of storytelling. So you have these young people who, you know, whether in Compton or Beverly Hills, again, very different spaces, they've been in these, I mean, I guess bubble is the common expression, in that, you know, they've been in these rooms with the same people for however many years, and suddenly they're projecting themselves out into the universe alongside, I mean, in California, University of California system, it's hundreds of thousands of people. In America as a whole, it's millions of people each year, just putting themselves out there to be judged against one another via their 600 word essays and their financial forms and other kind of more modern little gizmos they have to do. And So on one level, you know, applying to college, any form of college, from community to Ivy Leagues, you know, these kids ran the whole spectrum there. It's kind of a rite of passage for a lot of people, but when they're in it, it's this absolutely unique, stressful question of self-worth, and it was intense. We all got very wrapped up in it.
They seem to be very aware of how much this can impact their future. What school? I mean, all these kids seem to have that awareness. I'm not sure I had that at that age, or that my kids did at that age. Do you think it's? I do feel that the college admission process has changed over the years. People didn't apply to 6 or 8 colleges when I, you know, you kind of made your decision one or two, and you applied to one or two back in my day, which is older than your day. And then with my kids, it was still fairly limited. I think my daughter applied maybe three places, and she got into 2 and waitlisted on the other. And but it didn't. I don't feel like it had such the intensity that it does now. And people apply to like 8 or 10 now. Is that what you found?
Yeah, all those things.
Yeah.
Very much so. And what I didn't recall, and what I think maybe is new, just because of the modern world, is this connectivity and kind of hyper awareness of decimal points. And you can look at any school and see what the, you know, 25th percentile SAT score and GPA of kids accepted are. So it's all these kind of very specific measurements that they're holding themselves against, which I mean, that and a whole slew of reasons seem to make it particularly intense. The national obsession with rankings and elitism and all that. I'm not sure if that's new, but again, because there's so much access to numbers, I think it's definitely weightier.
I think we're all a little more aware of that now since the whole college admissions scandal happened a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Now, Jeff, some of the boys that you focus on are people of color, and some are not. And did you find a lot of difference, or was it all very similar in their experience?
I've mentioned the spaces. So the school in South LA, not in proper, but just north of Compton, and most of the boys grew up in Compton and really identified with that word and all its implications. That school was almost 100% Latino students, 98% or 99%, including a kid in my group who was undocumented, and he was actually applying to Ivy League schools and deferred action for childhood arrivals at the exact same time. And his name is Carlos. And and then the kids in Beverly Hills, I think most people would be surprised to know that most of the kids at Beverly Hills High School actually live in small apartments that their parents work pretty hard to afford, specifically so that their kids can go through a pretty good public system. And the, you know, the really rich kids tend to go private in that area. So even at Beverly Hills, there was a lot more diversity of experience than you'd probably expect. And so there was disparity all over the place under every desk. I mean, just the whether or not your parents applied to college themselves and can sort of help walk you through the process is, you know, a really huge deal. And not to sound kumbaya, but I tried to focus somewhat on commonality as well.
Right. Yeah, it does seem like, I mean, some of the kids were in fairly strained financial situations, but even the ones from wealthier homes, there were concerns about being able to afford college. And in sometimes, it's kind of upper middle class can be a hard place because for college finances, because you're not eligible for a lot of the aid, but you may not have the family income or assets to really pay full, you know, to pay the full fare. So that can be tricky,
I mean,
too.
The numbers are so high that that you know, everybody has to look twice. There was one student at Beverly Hills named Owen, who I also really admire, but he was the only one who was really from a wealthy family whereby they didn't really have to think about cost or anything like that. But, you know, it's not all about college, what they're going through. And so the same kid who, again, his family was very rich, his parents both very successful Hollywood creative people in television. So he's basically the perfect portrait of what you'd call a Beverly Hills kid. But I learned he didn't mention this for a while, but it came up that his mother was very ill and had been basically his entire high school experience. She was bedridden with a pretty mysterious, chronic, very painful illness. So every night, Owen, who again, if you saw him walking on the street, you'd think he probably doesn't have a care in the world, but every night he, while his friends went to the mall or whatnot, he'd go home and sit, you know, in a dark room next to his mother's bed and just try to make her laugh. And so he knew about pain and the randomness of things. And I thought that was pretty powerful as well.
Jeff, one of the things I really liked about this book is that the teachers and administrators and counselors seem to really care about these kids.
They really do, yeah.
Yeah, we have a tendency sometimes to always look at the bad parts and the people who are being discriminated against or schools that, you know, are just sort of letting kids flounder. But in my experience, most teachers do care and go above and beyond.
Yeah, it's constantly astonishing to me. Teachers for whom it really is a calling, or maybe it's not and they struggle with it, but I think very few people get into teaching for any reason other than to do right by young people. And I think this work and my work in general, I try to pay attention to people working in systems that are imperfect, that they didn't design, working in buildings they, you know, didn't lay any of the concrete on, and just trying to do good, teachers as well as students. And it is one of my regrets that I really, just because of balance and length in this book, I didn't pay the kind of tribute to teachers that I really would have liked to if I'd written, you know, a 500-page book instead of a 300-page book.
Well, yeah, you didn't, you know, really, we didn't really get to know the teachers on an individual basis, but it was obvious that, you know, you are paying a tribute to them in a way by showcasing how much they're helping.
Well, there's always
and they were all really kind, again, to let me sit in on their classes because teaching, I mean, the real magic of teaching is a very intimate interaction between adults and kids. And with what I do, it's hard not to feel invasive, like you are disrupting that somehow. But again, they were really kind to let me hang around. I remember after the 2016 presidential election happened, which, you know, no matter your politics, the result of that election was unexpected, and particularly in the South LA school, which I mentioned was almost all Latino kids. That election hurt just because a lot of the rhetoric that was going around. And I remember a teacher emailing me. I'd planned to go to that school the following day and be in government class and just hear the discussion. And the teacher emailed me the night before, once the results were kind of final, and said, maybe don't come tomorrow. It's going to be pretty grim. I don't really know what to expect, but we're all really uncertain kind of how these kids are going to respond. And then that was about 11 o'clock at night. And then he emailed probably 5 minutes later and said, actually, you know, come, this is important. And, these kids are resilient, and that might be, meaningful for you to see as well.
Wow.
So you did go.
I did. And, yeah, it was, like you said, it was grim, but, there was a lot of beauty in it as well. Just some kids were wearing signs around their neck that said free hugs. And and yeah, it was, you know, we were talking about teachers, and I was asking teachers at that school kind of how that national event changed the way they approached their classrooms and their profession in general, and if it, if it messed them up at all. And what they said was it actually energized them because their mission, their calling became to teach these kids to be less scared.
Oh, wow.
Well, because some of them were, you know, might have been, their parents were undocumented. That can be a real scary thing, and, you know, to give them confidence that they might be able to overcome that is really, really something.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jeff Hobbs, author of Show Them You're Good, A Portrait of Boys in the City of Angels the Year Before College. What is it about you, Jeff, that do you think that allowed these kids to open up to you?
Oh, that's I think mainly it's just that I'm an awkward guy, and you know, having a lot of experience at this point, walking into classrooms and speaking a little bit and trying to listen more than I talk, I've learned that the best thing and the worst thing about teenagers that you know, teachers and probably most parents of teenagers can identify with is that they don't care what you think of them, and they don't hide what they think of you. even if they're not saying it outright. And so, for instance, when we first started sitting down, my line or my pitch was that, and these kids were aware that I was also working in different schools. You know, I said, I hope you don't feel obligated to represent your race or your class or your neighborhood, or your school. As much as it's possible, I would, you know, I hope you just try to represent yourself, and I said that earnestly. That was my intention. But, you know, those guys at the same time said, you know, you're hanging out in a rich school and a poor school, so you definitely have some kind of agenda. So don't pretend like you don't. So they kind of got me immediately. So yeah, it's neat just kind of being forced to own up to all that and all of us just kind of be ourselves.
Now, have you stayed in touch with these boys since?
Yeah, very much. They just started their, most of them, some are a year behind, but they mostly just started their senior years in college. And that's been really the fun part, is keeping up with them. And they all helped me edit the book during their first few years in college.
Really? How did that work?
Well, it's possibly considered bad journalism. I think you're not generally supposed to let your sources, quote unquote, inform on the work you did. But I thought it was respectful, again, because they were courageous in putting themselves forward. They didn't have to. They weren't paid or anything. And B, just in terms of fact-checking, I thought it was just hugely helpful. Not just facts, numbers, places and times, but, you know, a lot of this book is just emotions and how people feel in different moments. So their retrospective reflections on that were really helpful, but that was the really fun part, is just that, you know, even a year removed from high school actually felt like eons to them in terms of growing up and experiences in the world. So, yeah, even 9 months later, guys were saying, like, I really said that? Man. I was so immature.
Well, one of the things, you know, and having raised a son and a daughter myself who are way past teenage, and actually my grandson is getting close to that age, it is so easy for a kid to make one mistake that in some of these situations wouldn't derail them terribly, but in others could totally derail their lives. And it was almost a relief that that didn't really happen to any of these young men.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine as a parent, my daughter is sort of on the verge of teenagerdom, and I'm already feeling that anxiety. A character in the book named Luis had in the spring of his senior year, had a moving violation with his car that was actually his brother's car that wasn't totally registered, and many layers of complications that you know, that incident could have, it turned out all right, but it really could have turned out badly for him. And I would say, we spoke earlier about commonality and differences, and that's a huge difference between the two neighborhoods, is the kids in Beverly Hills certainly have more leeway to make mistakes and a lot more cushions across the board.
Absolutely. So, Jeff, why don't you read a little bit from the book?
Sure, I'd love to. This is a fairly short passage. It was one of my favorite days in the research, and I like this part of the book. So the Onomatopoeia Brown, the school in South LA, was very small, physically small. They didn't have sports fields or sports teams, but they had a group that trained to run the LA Marathon, in the spring of that year, and one of the students, Gio, was part of that group, and so all year they trained and went to the beach and increased their mileage, and then ran the marathon, which just running a marathon is hugely a huge accomplishment. But also for me, kind of through gridlock traffic, pursuing his little group across LA, it was neat just to see them traverse the entire city and all these different neighborhoods. And this is just what happened when he finished 26 miles later. Upon finishing, Tio had weakly taken his medal and walked in the direction in which the herd seemed to be walking. His breathing was measured, his legs numb. The finish was on Ocean Avenue, high above the shore. This westernmost sliver of Los Angeles was one of its most objectively gorgeous, and the cool sea breeze padded the endorphin-rich feeling. He passed a food table where volunteers doled out bananas, granola bars, energy drinks, doses of Advil. He took two of everything. He called his girlfriend a few times to say he would wait for her until she started yelling at him because she had 2 miles left and he kept bothering her during the hardest stretch, so he forgot about her. He vaguely remembered that he was supposed to gather at Santa Monica High School with other team runners to sign a sheet that proved he'd finished, as if his exhaustion wasn't proof enough. The campus was another mile away, slow step by slow step. His mother was waiting there, and he hugged her. "Where's the car?" he asked. She shook her head. "No car." "Shoot." They walked the mile back to the metro station near the finish line. He was nearing 30 miles for the day. On the train, he texted his girlfriend that he was heading home, and she was mad at him about that as well. "You said you would wait for me." He fell asleep at some point, and his mom jostled him awake for the change to the blue line to South LA. Saliva had drooled from his mouth onto his running shirt. At home before dusk, he showered and lay down and found that neither his mind nor his body would relax. In fact, he was suddenly feeling antsy and energized and loath to be alone after this day of traversing his native city. His legs burned with a kind of electricity. He texted a skater friend. 30 minutes later, they were at the skateboard park. Tio squatted on his board, steering toward a ramp, pushing for the velocity to carry him upward, rising, falling, landing, over and over and over, sometimes falling in the twilight. The next morning, a school day, he found that he couldn't walk at all.
And that was Jeff Hobbs reading from Show Them You're Good. I did a long bike ride last weekend, so I sort of know how he felt at the end. It was not nearly as long as that, and not very long for some people, but it was like 3 times longer than I normally ride, and so for me it was a big deal.
That feels good.
Yeah. It all depends on where you're starting from, you know what.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering. Did you take, when you were interviewing and talking with these young men, did you take notes at that time? I mean, how did you remember all these details?
Oh, yeah, I recorded everything.
Oh, okay.
I have a little gizmo for that.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, there were moments where maybe things were very personal or details about their parents that they didn't want in the book where, you know, they said to turn that off, and I did.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I ended up with nearly 2,000 pages of kind of single-spaced transcripts from those interviews.
Oh, wow.
I can believe that, yeah.
Now, how did you make the transcripts? Was it a computer program that did it? Was it, AI?
I just listen and type them out.
Seriously? That must have taken forever.
Yeah, it's tedious work, and it's not the funnest part of this kind of work. But it's also, maybe there's a cognitive term for it, it's like secondary imprinting. So I think it's really important to go through that part because, you know, it just...
It helps you get a feel for what the narrative store, where what the narrative is, and how you're going to organize it.
It just kind of sets the details in my own consciousness, and it's during that process where just a lot of the, I mean, books like this, the small moments are the most important moments. You know, maybe the ones that in the seeing or the telling don't necessarily stand out, but upon going through it all again, take on some kind of meaning. So, for instance, the title of the book, Show Them You're Good, came from Tio. He's the guy who just ran the marathon. He was, as in the passage I read, he mostly what he talked about was skateboarding. And so he was talking about how you go to skate parks and it's very hierarchical and territorial and kids are kind of rough and they try to chase you out. And he said, they just hate on you until you show them you're good. Which in the room when he said that, you know, it was just part of one of many monologues he gave about skateboarding, which could get a little redundant. You know, once I looked at it again, it just seemed to have many layers of meaning, not just for this time of life that the boys were in, but any time of life.
True. Yeah, there's definitely lessons in this for people of all ages, not just high school kids.
That is true.
So when it came time, when you did these interviews, they were spread out over a school year. Did you wait until the end to start actually putting the book together, or did you do that as you went along?
I did wait until the end. Not necessarily by plan, and that sure makes everything take longer, mainly because it was just busy. I was in these schools almost every day for the isolated conversations we have, but also again being at classes and talking to teachers and just being out and about, and then it was always a rush to pick up my own kids from school and get to that, which is just kind of the life. It wasn't till they'd graduated and I finished with all, there were no more events to attend, let's say, that I could sort of sit and try to see if it was worthwhile.
And then how long did the process take before you had a manuscript?
Let me think. I write pretty fast, relatively, I think, once all is said and done. Probably 9 months then.
Yeah, that is pretty fast. But the book is organized as a basically chronologically through the school year. And was that always, you know, was that an easy decision to make?
Yeah, and that's something I learned from my editor, who was a guy I just think the world of and can't say enough good things about. But when I was writing my first nonfiction book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, because I came from writing novels, I had inclinations to try to do fancy things with time and jump around and you know, do that dance. And at a certain point, he told me somewhat sternly that, you know, the key to telling a story is just to tell the story. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to tap dance.
I think it was good advice, yeah. Because especially with something like this where you have so many characters, so many people that we're getting to know throughout the story, you're jumping around between points of view. If you were jumping around in time, too, I think it would just be too confusing.
Yeah, and I know there are a lot of characters which which, you know, might be tough. It might be asking a lot of some readers. So there's four main boys, two in each school, and nine boys in total, kind of friendships and peripheral guys in the schools. But I would say that's kind of the hardest part, not technically, but emotionally with this kind of work, is you're with people, you're drawn to a place, people give you so much and put themselves out there, and you have just feelings and admiration for everybody. And then again, the demands of a narrative space and time and balance mean that, you know, you have to sort of cut people down and make choices. And
were there some people that even got cut out completely?
There were, I'm afraid. And as I said, it was for different reasons. And that was really hard to. And they were all so graceful about
Aww.
It. And I thanked them profusely in the acknowledgments. But I guess you feel like a football coach having to tell, you know, a kid who works really hard and you really like that, that he kind of didn't make the final number.
Yeah. So, Jeff, did you have a contract for this book as you were working on it?
I did not.
Oh,
when
wow.
I was doing the research.
I kind of
again,
assumed
I
you were going to say
I
you did, because how did you keep going so long and put so much into it, not knowing if it would work out?
Well, it was sort of funny. It's something I kept saying to the guys again as the hours piled up, and they gave so much, is that I truly didn't know if anybody would publish my odd little high school book, which was true. I mean, you know, I had I knew I would work pretty hard, and that I'm not terrible at this, so I I had hope.
And
but,
it worked
you
out.
Know, there's a lot of there's a lot of humility involved, and then even if. Thankfully, I got to continue working with the same editor who I mentioned before. You know, it's just a lot of faith that if you're drawn to a place and you're finding all these little nuances that you didn't know about before, that that maybe a few other people might be drawn to it as well.
Well, I think people will be drawn to this, and it's, I like reading this type, what you called immersive journalism, where we're really getting to know people, the lives of people that on the surface I would have very little in common with, being different gender, different geographical location, different age, you know, everything. But I see I get to feel like I know them. And to me, that's one of the best reasons to read a book.
I agree.
That's very kind of you to say. And that's always the intention. I mean, when you're writing about people who you'd never meet, whose names you'll never hear, who aren't famous, but you know, knowing them might kind of change some presumptions people have.
Exactly. And this is a very good time for that to be happening, since we have so much division and so much fear of the other in our world today. So this book kind of wipes that away and say, hey, we're all human.
We're all in this together.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I risk sounding kumbaya, but the hope is just if you know, you get to know people and maybe you if it starts with feeling, if you feel more, then you'll want to know more, and then you can do more.
Mom, we're about out of time. Do you have some closing words for us today?
Well, I do, actually. Of course, you know, my main thing is every life has a story, and this, of course, really points that out. But the main thing is that we can all learn from one another. If we just open our ears and, listen more than we talk, let's put it that way.
And, Jeff, I think you did that. Obviously, you did that very well.
You did.
Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Oh, thank you. You guys are so kind, and I really just appreciate your time and your questions and having me on your wonderful show.
Well, you're very welcome. And bye, Mom, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye, everybody.